Hey guys, how are y'all doing? Welcome to the show. Well, I'm Scott Horton, and this is my show, The Scott Horton Show. And so, of course, today on the show, Gareth Porter. Well, you know, he's my favorite reporter, and he just happens to have that very same part of a word in his name. Gareth Porter, the reporter. Tells it like it is, and he's going to be on to finish the interview that we started yesterday. His new piece for Truth Out on the so-called Syrian government sarin attack from last August, which he doesn't seem to think is any such thing. Anyway, so Gareth Porter will be back on the show. And man, I've been trying so hard to get Anand Gopal back on the show, but I guess part of the reason I can't get him back on the show so easily, I can't even really ever get a hold of him in time to schedule anything. And I'm pretty sure that the reason why is because he's such a good journalist that he's so busy being a journalist, he has very little time to check his emails for regular stuff and to show up on radio shows. Good news, his brand new book is out. And I'll be reading it and interviewing him about it as soon as I can. But today I'm going to interview him about, first and foremost, this piece about the Haqqani Network and America's horribly botched occupation of Afghanistan, lo, these many years. And also, he wrote this thing for Harper's with Matthew Akins about the recent elections in Afghanistan, and hardly anybody's written anything substantial about that at all, so I'd like to ask him about that, too, and, of course, help him promote his book, and I can't wait to read his book. And well, I don't want to waste this whole segment telling you, you know, I could just talk on and on about Anand Gopal. But anyway, he used to write for the Wall Street Journal and for the Christian Science Monitor, right? Anyway, he spent a lot of time, years and years and years, I believe, in Afghanistan. And he really explained a lot previously. I've interviewed him many times on the show about the history of the early years of the war in Afghanistan and the political decisions made and how everything came to be. And he has a really unique insight. That's all I'm trying to tell you. I won't go through the whole list of what I learned from him so far. But I do want you to go look. This one is at Tom Dispatch. Is it at antiwar.com today or yesterday it was? All you got to do is go to Tom Engelhardt's name on the right side of the page there at antiwar.com, page down a little bit. Yeah, here it is. It ran yesterday at antiwar.com, How to Lose a War That Wasn't There. And it's at Tom Dispatch, too. So, all right. Anand Gopal and Gareth Porter coming up on the show today. By the way, you could listen to this show at APSRadioNews.com. At dailypaulradio.com, at anomalyradio.com, at scotthorton.org/listen. And join up the chat room at scotthorton.org/chat. It's an IRC Freenode chat, but you don't need any kind of external programs or applications or anything anymore. Just go to a plain old browser window and go to scotthorton.org/chat. Join up the chat room and say hi to everybody. It's fun, man. New listeners, and I guess old listeners got to get tired of it and go away after a time sometimes, but there's always new listeners, and lately there have been some new listeners showing up in the chat room saying hi and that kind of thing, so always dig that. So please stop by if you feel like it. And also follow me on Twitter, at Scott Horton Show, if you want to know what I'm angry about at any given moment. Then I'll tweet those angry things right at you. And then you can retweet me. All right, so, man, what a bummer, dude. I don't mean to be such a bummer, guys. That's just the news. Jason Ditz at news.antiwar.com. Iraq vote sets stage for another sectarian battle. And this piece was written yesterday. It's short and sweet. And it reads, Iraq went to vote today in its first post-occupation national election. The vote largely went off smoothly, which officials attributed to security forces across the nation. From Al-Qaeda's perspective, there was really no need to attack the polling places, however, as the vote itself is liable to be more destabilizing for the country than anything they could have done. The 2010 election saw a Sunni-dominated secular bloc winning the popular vote, which was incredible, by the way. And the U.S. imposing a power-sharing deal that left Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki the ruler anyway. The power-sharing never came. This time around, many of the Sunnis didn't even get to vote. Most of the polling stations in the Anbar province never opened, with al-Qaeda controlling the major cities there. Resentment over seeing their election win in 2010 go for naught is likely to pale in comparison to not getting to vote at all in this one. Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki not only didn't follow through on power sharing, but centralized power greatly in the past few years, and is now seen as a given that he will remain no matter what the results of this election actually are. The post-vote coalition negotiations are going to be difficult, with no one likely to willingly deal with Maliki after the last time, and no group likely to successfully take power without his permission. So there you go. That whole war just to replace one dictatorship with another. One population of Baghdad with another. That was where all the bloodletting came. Came from. And so, yeah, here you go. They had a giant election, and just like January 05, only the Shiites got to participate in it. So the what's left, they still call it the United Iraqi Alliance. The Supreme Islamic Council is basically gone now. And Sadr says that he's not participating or endorsing. He hates Maliki, apparently. But I think some of his people are still, you know, part of the government there. But, you know, all Maliki had to do was not appoint people to fill the top cabinet positions, and then he's the top cabinet position. That was pretty easy. So there you go. The Shia Saddam, that's what they call him. And, of course, it's probably oversimplifying to call the whole rebellion in Iraq al-Qaeda, because still it's the tribal chiefs there who have decided to go back to war to some degree. To what degree, you know, the so-called Islamic State of Iraq is really calling the shots, I guess I can't say. I'm afraid to ask David Enders to go back there and find out and tell me, you know what I mean? I guess I can talk to Patrick Coburn about it. Poor old David Enders. That guy deserves a vacation, man. But, you know, Maliki's been screwing all the Sunnis in Iraq. So it ain't just the jihadist suicide bombers there. Syria, I don't know, man. I think, as it has been, as David Enders has told us, and all other indications, the rebellion in Syria is basically the al-Qaeda rebellion. That's where they've gone, mostly. The al-Nusra Front, which is outright loyal to Ayman al-Zawahiri, and the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria, or Iraq and the Sham, which is what they call that region in their dialect of Arabic. Whatever, I don't know the etymology of the whole damn thing, but that's what they call it, the Sham, the Sham, something. Anyway, ISIS, the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria. Now, they've fallen out of favor with Ayman al-Zawahiri. They used to, you know, swear their loyalty to him, but he was really stupid, actually. He issued commands to them that he couldn't have really reasonably expected them to follow. Leave Syria. Go back to Iraq and just fight there. And these guys are like, whatever, dude. You're hiding in somebody's attic in Pakistan. You don't get to tell us what to do. They're already in the middle of a war. They're going to turn around and leave? It's interesting to me the way, have you noticed? Everyone seems to agree that the problem is that ISIS is too brutal for Al-Qaeda. Which, you know, I suppose it's true that Zawahiri's suggestion to them or command to them was to tamp down the collateral damage a little bit, but that's not for morality's sake. It's just, you know, tactically, that can backfire, although that's the purpose of terrorism, is backfire. The action is in the reaction, so I don't know who put out that podcast. Maybe it wasn't Zawahiri after all. Maybe it was, and he forgot his own damn game, or I don't know what the hell, but these guys are prisoner beheaders, suicide bombers, and here they are in the Daily Mail. You can see the pictures of them crucifying people to death. Or maybe they're already dead. I don't know. Literally crucifying people. The Islamic State of Iraq. Oh, they're calling them ISIL here. The Islamic State of Iraq and the Levant. But anyway, Al-Qaeda in Iraq. Zarqawi's group. You know, the one that never existed before America invaded in 2003. Because Saddam Hussein killed them all to death immediately as soon as they cropped their head up whatsoever. And, here they are. These are the rebels America's backing, at least, you know, by a degree or two of separation. And, you know, the rumors are that they've backed off backing. I guess Hirsch reports they've backed off the degree of armaments that they've sent them. But still, this is, to a great degree, America's war there, where we're now on the side of the bad guys on the other side of the line in Iraq. What the hell is that?
So you're a libertarian, and you don't believe the propaganda about government awesomeness you were subjected to in fourth grade. You want real history and economics. Well, learn in your car from professors you can trust with Tom Woods's Liberty Classroom. And if you join through the Liberty Classroom link at scotthorton.org, we'll make a donation to support the Scott Horton Show. Liberty Classroom, the history and economics they didn't teach you.
Hey, y'all, Scott here. Man, I had a chance to have an essay published in the book Why Peace, edited by Mark Gutman, but I didn't understand what an opportunity it was. Boy, do I regret I didn't take it. This compendium of thoughts by the greatest anti-war writers and activists of our generation will be remembered and studied long into the future. You've got to get Why Peace. You've got to read Why Peace. It features articles by Harry Brown, Robert Naiman, Fred Bronfman, Dahlia Wasfey, Richard Cummings, Karen Katowski, Butler Schaefer, Kathy Kelly, Robert Higgs, Anthony Gregory, and so many more. Why peace? Because war is the health of everything wrong with our society. Get Why Peace. Down at the bookshop or Amazon.com. Just click the book in the right margin at scotthorton.org.
All right. Welcome back to the show, guys. And you look at this. The April 6th movement. The young radicals. The liberals from Cairo, who were the a major part of the Arab Spring 3 years ago, has now been banned by the military dictatorship that they helped overthrow the Muslim Brotherhood last summer. You idiots, man. You had actual civilians, elected civilians in power, and the possibility of actual regular elections and not just a sock puppet military dictator, and then you took the military side against the conservative civilians, and now look at you. You dummies. And you know, I didn't see it, but I read a few reviews of the big documentary about the young liberals, and I can sympathize with them, man. You know, It's the same problem as everybody. It's the same problem I got and you got too. Everybody's looking at everything through a soda straw. Nobody can ever really see the big picture, what it all means and how it all fits and what it's all about. And from their point of view, man, they hate the Muslim Brotherhood. Why in the world would they have an agreement, you know? It's not just the Republicans and the Democrats, but it's worse, right? Further to the left and further to the right. And try to get these further to the left than the Democrat young groups to deal with these further to the right than the Republican old Islamist groups and get them to see eye to eye that it's civilian, regular, democratic elections and a move toward an actual rule of law and a dissolution of power from the military state is the order of the day, is the most important goal that everybody can agree on to get them. Not, it just, it couldn't work. It didn't work. And who knows what all forces were allied against them the whole time, including the Americans and the Saudis and everybody else. The military dictatorship itself. And, you know, the military dictatorship in Egypt, the military in Egypt, those generals, they own the economy. I mean, it's worse than the PLA in China or something in terms of their ownership of the civilian industries and even the tourism and everything. And so it was never going to be easy at all. But man, and you know what? The Muslim Brotherhood, it's all their fault too. Stupid ass old Republican conservative Islamist jerks who refuse to work with, should have been, guys, anyone who's not the military dictatorship. Anyone who's not the military deep state, you have to forge an alliance with them based on, hey, let's have civilian democratic rule and regular elections and win some, lose some, and try to create a real rule of law and judiciary and Nope, they didn't do that either. They blew it. And they had the steepest hill to climb. We've talked with Adam Morrow on the show for years, from IPS especially, about the steepest hill in the world that they had to climb to do it. The entire executive branch of the government of Egypt basically refused to accept direction from the elected Muslim Brotherhood government. I mean, in hell, Morsi was their fourth or fifth runner-up because the judiciary, which is allied with, so-called judiciary, allied with the military, disqualified all of the quote-unquote best leaders. The most capable and charismatic leaders of the Muslim Brotherhood were all disqualified from the election. So they had to run Dan Quayle, you know? They had to run some dumbass. And so he wasn't, I mean, you know, whatever. He wasn't the best that they could have done by a long shot. Anyway, so there's your Arab Spring, man. Whole thing fell apart. And then you had the people who participated in the civilian peaceful revolution together turn on each other and now allow the full-scale foreign-backed military dictatorship rule over the country again, with Field Marshal Sisi as the next Mubarak for the next 30 years. It's a crying shame what's happened there, man, isn't it? I think so. All right, and now I think I have enough time. I want to play y'all this clip, and then I want to make a couple of points about it. I think you'll get where I'm coming from. This is Gideon Rose. I've mentioned this a couple times on the show, but I decided it was instructive enough to catch up with it. It's Gideon Rose, and he is the editor of Foreign Affairs, which is the Journal of the Council on Foreign Relations, which is, you know, the center of the most prestigious, respected foreign policy establishment. Yeah, 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 going back 90 years, right? Okay, so 95. So he's the editor of their establishment journal, and he's on Colbert. And so because of that, it's almost like they gave him some wine, right? He's kind of joking around. He's getting kind of right to the point about what's going on here. And this is from the very end of February, this is probably the 21st, 22nd, something. I'm sorry, the exact date. I guess I can Google it while it's playing. But it's the end of February, and he's explaining the American role in provoking the crisis in Ukraine. And I think it's a bit instructive here.
It's basically Robin to Russia's Batman. And the challenge here, is to try to attract it to the West, to get it to flip sides.
Is America taking sides in this in any way? If these people, the rebels are winning right now, right?
Yes, just
so
recently.
Why isn't Obama spiking the ball in the end zone and calling Putin and saying, hey, you might have won the medal count, but we won the country count, biatch.
It's actually a very good question, and the answer is that we don't want Russia to intervene and kick over the table like a game of Risk and take Ukraine back. And
so would they do that? Could he send in troops?
Yes, he could. So we are choosing...
Now, does Ukraine have any troops of their own? Would they fight back?
Yes, but we don't want this to escalate, and we don't want Russia to crack down. So we want to basically distract Russia. Oh, look, you have the highest medal count. Oh, you did really well. And, you know,
possible?
Focus on the Olympics. Here's
a policy establishment. It's all a big joke. We're taking this country that he describes. He's on the comedy show. He describes it as Robin to Russia's Batman. And he says, we're trying to take this country away from them and have them come to us. away from Russia and toward us. And so why isn't Obama spiking the ball in the end zone and laughing and pointing his finger at Putin and saying, ha, we got away with the rebels? And I'm sorry, it was from February the 24th. So this is 2 days after the Western-backed coup leaders in Western Ukraine, when they took power, never mind the fact that eight major leaders of the fascist parties, Right Sector and Svoboda, became part of the government, became ministers in the government, and the Right Sector thugs started being brought into the so-called new National Guard units and all of that. Even besides all that, which that's kind of a big deal, wouldn't you think? But even besides all that, the first thing they did was try to outlaw Russian and for president or prime minister, whichever. But she's basically saying, you know, like Goldwater saying, saw off the eastern seaboard. Well, they answered back with, you get no votes from us, right? And that's what she's saying is, you know, damn them, everyone east of the Mississippi River. They're all horrible, terrible people, and screw them, she's announcing, basically. And so what's their reaction to that? You have no right to rule. And it's easy to say, and it's true, that these are pro-Russian protesters seizing these Breton sanctions against all of the billionaires from the Party of Regions, which was Yanukovych's party, and told them, you better forsake this guy, or we're going to forsake all of y'all's foreign bank accounts and holdings. And so they went ahead, and it was the Americans, you know, in world power, in with their banking and treasury agency powers, and Nazi street toughs outright. I mean, with the proud symbols and slogans of the Christian Science Monitor, and I've interviewed him many times in the past about the war in Afghanistan and Pakistan, and here he is at Tom Dispatch with a great new piece, How to Lose a War That Wasn't There. And I guess it's based on, in part, on his book. And you can find different excerpts published in different places. It's a brand new book out, which I don't have my copy yet, but I'm getting it today. And it's No Good Men Among the Living: America, the Taliban, and the War Through Afghanistan.
2001, when the invasion took place, but very quickly that changed.
Right. And so, well, and why was that? He couldn't just call some old guys from Ghost Wars days?
Well, you know, he was looking for a face-saving way to cut a deal with the U.S. in 2001, and these were his old friends, so it wasn't that far-fetched that that would be the case. But very quickly, the U.S. found other allies in the region, and that was sort of the mood at the time, which was, you were either with us or he came from the rural south. He came from a different part of the country, from the east. And, you know, when the Taliban took power, they gave him a basically sort of a cabinet position that didn't have much power. So he had a very nominal authority under the Taliban regime. So he was allied with the Taliban, but he was distinct. Mm.
All right, now, I'm not one really to ever advocate invasions or then propping up mean old warlords in power after invading countries either, but it sort of sounds here like they made an enemy out of this guy where they didn't
have... but, you know, there was this idea of a set of guys who are bad guys who are always going to be opposed to the U.S., and this, again, is the with us or against us mentality, and that sort of ideological perspective did not allow these sorts of deals to take place. And instead, the very people who tried to join the Hamid Karzai government, like Haqqani, were actually attacked and driven to the Taliban.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, the way you talk about it in the article, it sure seems like he tried quite a few times to come and suck up to the at that point, other than, you know, Mullah Omar and his six closest friends cowering somewhere over the line in Pakistan. Because it doesn't seem like the trouble with them started back up again until, what, 04, 05?
Well, that's right. In fact, during the invasion itself, there were thousands of people who were killed. Many of them were Taliban foot soldiers. But after that, there was no more Taliban. The Taliban had ceased to exist as an organized entity. And most of those people who had been in the Taliban, they basically one-sided killing, more or less. I mean, there's very little fighting against the Americans. It was all the U.S. forces killing people who were more often than not innocent civilians. And that is what created the space for the Taliban to reconstitute itself. So by 2004 and 2005, it had become a strong insurgency.
Yeah. All right, I want to talk about that a little bit more on the other side of the break. But for now, tell us a little bit about your new book.
The book follows the lives of three Afghans. One is a Taliban fighter, one is a warlord who's backed by the U.S., and one is a housewife, a village housewife. Mm-hmm. And it charts their lives from 2001 till very recently. And it uses their story to try to illuminate how this war looked like from the eyes of Afghans. And it turns out it looks very, very differently than it does from the point of view of people here, of course.
Right. Well, and I guess one of the excerpts that I read was part of the story of the housewife there, and it was very interesting, and I just have to assume that...
Terry Industrial Complex, the disastrous rise of misplaced power...
Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here. I'd like for you to read this book, The War State, by Michael Swanson. America's always gone to war a lot, though in older times it would disarm for a bit between each one. But in World War II, the U.S. built a military and intelligence apparatus so large, it ended up reducing the former constitutional government to an almost ceremonial role and converting our economy into an engine of destruction. In The War State, Michael Swanson does a great job telling the sordid history of the rise of this national security state, relying on important first-hand book, No Good Men Among the Living, America, the Taliban, and the War Through Afghan Eyes. So now, we talked about and on how they... refused to accept this guy's surrender, basically, repeatedly, and kept bombing him, but sort of like solder, they didn't ever kill him. They just made an enemy out of him and chased him out of the country, where he's safe on the other side of the line. And then, eventually, they ended up chasing him. Thank goodness they didn't do this in Iraq and chase solder to Iran. Anyway, they chased, say in the article that by now, they basically won that drone war. They bombed so many of these guys, they even killed Haqqani's son, right? And that now they've moved on to find other enemies to kill?
Yeah, I mean, they've killed most people in the Haqqani family. But, you know, the terrible thing about this is that even that doesn't mean that the war is over, because now it's just spawned off new groups, even more radical groups than the Haqqanis, that are now in the crosshairs that, you know, we're going to continue fighting the war against. And, you know, the way this looks, it looks like fighting in perpetuity with no end in sight.
Well, they say they're going to leave 10,000 troops. I mean, they assume they'll have a immunity deal from whoever replaces Karzai, and then they'll keep 10,000 troops there in order to continue waging the drone war. Do you think that's about what's going to happen?
Yeah, that's right. The drone war and night raids, targeted killings. There are CIA paramilitary groups, these are Afghans that are being armed and trained and paid by the CIA, mm-hmm. that are running around Afghanistan, and they're going to continue doing that. You know, I think it's going to look a lot like some of the things we've seen in the 1980s, El Salvador and Nicaragua, sort of these kinds of dirty wars that are just going to continue for a very long time.
Well, and then do they have anyone to fight other than the Taliban? And who even is the Taliban? Of course, they always lump, here we're differentiating between Haqqani and the larger Taliban movement or the smaller one, whatever the case may be. But, of course, the government and the newspapers always just want to say anyone who resists American occupation there is the Taliban. But, well, for example, if America left, could they come back to power? How much authority, how much manpower do they really have there?
It's not likely they can come back to power. I mean, they're pretty strong in their areas, which is deep in the countryside. They're not going to be able to march into the cities. They're not going to be able to take over Kabul. And the reason for that is because the U.S., is paying for the Afghan government and paying for the Afghan army. And so the Afghan government, the Afghan army, and various other security forces are more well-funded and more well-equipped and have a greater manpower than do the Taliban. So that doesn't mean, on the other hand, though, that the Taliban are going to be defeated, because these groups, such as the Afghan army, are not going to be able to go in to these villages and try to eradicate the Taliban. That's not going to happen either. So it's really going to be two entrenched sides for a very long time.
Yeah, I wonder about the new Afghan army. I mean, they've been a joke for so long, but I guess I can't deny the possibility that the special forces or whoever have been able, the contractors, have been able to figure out how to train a corps of a few tens of thousands of guys to actually be an army? Or are they still just a joke or what?
Well, look, you know, it doesn't take much here to hold the city. okay, because you don't need to be the most sophisticated army in the world. I mean, keep in mind, you're fighting against the Taliban who are fighting in sandals and have, you know, RPGs, and that's about it. So, you know, what it takes is you need to keep the money flowing so that most people who join the Afghan army are doing it because they need a job. And so as long as there's a prospect of getting a paycheck, there's going to be Afghans who are going to sign up for that. And so that's what's happening. And so as long as that continues, as long as you keep pouring billions upon billions of dollars into the country, I think the Afghan army is going to hold together, and they're going to be able to defend the city.
And then, so is there any chance that we can declare victory and go ahead and leave and just keep bankrolling the government there? I mean, not that I'm in favor of that, but it's better than occupying the place still. Or they really need the Americans' help to keep the Taliban and whoever else at bay.
No, I don't think they actually need U.S. soldiers on the ground to do that. Like I said, even in this last year, there have been actually very few instances of the U.S. military actually going outside the wire and fighting. It's been almost all Afghan army and Afghan police. As long as they're funded, as long as they keep getting weapons, you know, they'll keep fighting. Of course, the problem with that as well is that, you know, there's no end game for that, because are we just going to pay them forever? You know, this is something that needs to be thought about. But it is true that if we keep paying them, I think it'll hold together and the Taliban won't be able to kick them out.
Yeah. Well, of course, that is a big problem. Well, so let me ask you this. That's one example of it, right? Foreign, very high dollar funding of their army that could not be sustainable from just domestic sources. I wonder about the power of those who are, say, for example, fighting over the recounts and the runoffs in the recent elections and the different warlords in Kabul and all of that, and how natural any of their power is if it didn't have American, you know, firepower. Not necessarily the whole regime, but the individuals within it, the different working parts of it. How much power any of those warlords might have, et cetera, without American money and weapons backing them up.
Oh, they would have no power. And I would even go further and say the entire regime wouldn't last a day without American firepower and weapons and money backing it up. The moment we pull the plug on funding, I think the government collapses.
So it's not necessarily that because the Taliban is so powerful and we're holding them off and they will sack Kabul. It's just that nobody else wants them either. They don't have any support outside the foreigners, basically.
Yeah, and, you know, the thing is, like, if you look at the Afghan government, it has no revenue. You know, there's no taxes that are collected. There's no industry. There's nothing. So the only way the government stays together, I mean, how do you even pay police officers? Right? Where do you get the money to pay the police? It has to come from the U.S. There's no way for this government to get money domestically. So this is the problem. And so as long as that's the case, you know, really, it's a really weak government that we're propping up against an insurgency that on its own isn't that strong, but compared to this really weak government, looks strong.
Right. Well, and then, so what about, you know, characters like Dostum and Hekmatyar and some of these guys who, I mean, aren't they the notorious warlords of the massive slaughter of the 1990s before the Taliban came to power? That's how the Taliban came to power, was because of how horrible these guys were, that people were even willing to accept the Taliban if they would get rid of Dostum and Hekmatyar for them, right? But now these are our guys over there, no?
Well, those are our guys, but, you know, something interesting has happened in the last 10 years where these guys like Dostum, they're there, they're in Kabul, they're not that powerful. But in the course of fighting the war on terror, we've created 20 new Dostums that people haven't even heard about necessarily outside of Afghanistan, who are in the countryside, who hold sway over parts of the country and you know, are very brutal. And they're one of the main reasons why even to this day you'll see poor villagers sometimes turn towards the Taliban, because there's some pretty outrageous human rights abuses that are happening daily, and a lot of those stories don't come out. I do describe some of them in my book and sort of profile some of these new warlords that we've created in the last 10 years.
Yep, so the only end game is no end game. They can scale it down, but they can't call it quits without the whole thing falling apart, huh?
That's right. I know it's a bleak assessment, but unfortunately that's the consequence of our policies in the last 10 years.
All right. Well, what if I had the power and I just made it that way anyway? Would it be a matter then of Iran and Russia and India and Pakistan fighting over who rules what and a whole other era of war?
You mean if the U.S. money stopped? Or?
Yeah, if I had my way and I forced a complete American withdrawal, what would happen instead?
to complete American withdrawal and cutting off all money would lead to the government collapsing. We would see a repeat of the 1990s with various militias and warlords fighting against each other. There probably would be heavy fighting in Kabul. You may see the surrounding neighboring countries like Iran getting more involved. Pakistan, of course, is already very involved. I think civil war is the short answer for what would happen.
Yeah. Well, that sort of goes to show that what we've done isn't really create a democracy where people have anything like proportional representation in the country. What we've created is massive distortions of power. Anyway, hard crash coming one way or the other, I guess. Listen, I'm going to read your book. I can't wait to read it, Anand. It's so great to talk to you again. This article at Tom Dispatch is actually absolutely mind-blowing, I mean to say. So thank you very much for your time on the show again.
Thanks, Scott. Appreciate it.
All right, that's Anand Gopal, everybody, AnandGopal.com, and he's also at TomDispatch.com. How to Lose a War That Wasn't There. The new book is No Good Men Among the Living. Buy it. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future of Freedom Foundation. Edited by libertarian purist Sheldon Richman, The Future of Freedom brings you the best of our movement, featuring articles by Richman, Jacob Hornberger, James Bovard, and many more. The Future of Freedom stands for peace and liberty, and against our criminal world empire and Leviathan state. Subscribe today. It's just $25 per year for the back pocket size print edition, $15 per year to read it online. That's The Future of Freedom at fff.org/subscribe. Peace and freedom. Thank you. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. You know, Anand, he gives short answers, and still that interview went fast, right? I can't wait to read that book. He's great. Go back to the archives and listen to all my different interviews of Anand from back in the past. He's really good, man. Kind of fade that out too quickly, didn't I? All right, so... Yeah. Well, I think he's right that if America leaves, the situation in Afghanistan will be horrible. But that's like saying if the Federal Reserve stops printing money, there'll be a crash. Yeah, but the reason there's a artificial boom is because they're printing money. And in this case, there's an artificial boom in the amount of power that Gulbuddin Hekmatyar has, and others like him. And when America leaves, yeah, it's going to crash. The bubble's going to pop. And it's going to be a mess. But that just goes to show, you know, this whole project of, yeah, we're going to give them a representative government so that they don't have to kill each other fighting over power anymore. They can just have regular elections and all that kind of crap. Yeah, that's a bunch of crap. It's now 2014. And one of the best reporters in the West out of Afghanistan is saying, oh, yeah, no, if it wasn't for America making it the way it is now, even without the military force, at least with their billions, forget about it. So, how long are you willing to pay billions to prop up the government in Kabul till it's trillions? All right. Problematic. Hey, tomorrow Jonathan Landay is on the show. You know, he's a reporter for McClatchy. He used to be for Knight Ridder, but they got bought. But anyway, point is, back in Knight Ridder days, he was printing article after article from right after September 11th on, about how the war party is obsessed with Iraq, and they're going to Iraq, and they're willing to tell any lie. And the regular working stiffs at the CIA are going, whoa, what in the fuck, man? I don't, huh? Wow, they created their own little fake CIA at the Pentagon just to lie us into war. This is going to be really, really bad for our actual terrorism problem, as opposed to our pretend Iraq-backed one that doesn't actually exist. And now, here again with the whole this many years later rap. And this many years later, what happened? We got, as we talked about earlier in the show, Anbar and all the Sunni provinces of Iraq are lawless free fire zones where Zarqawi's old group, the Islamic State of Iraq, just runs rampant. They've spread their jihad into Syria, into Libya, onto Mali. And the State Department has a new terrorism report out. And Landay's got a good write-up of it. Giraldi always does a good write-up of this every year when they come out with their new terrorism report. And the reason that I would even mention it to you, the reason that it's really newsworthy, is not because, oh, look at what these lying jerks are claiming. It's actually because they've typically been pretty objective and sort of congressional budget office-y in their assessments of what's going on. You know what I mean? It's kind of a professional intelligence report. And they've been in the habit, at least, of not blowing things out of proportion. You know, Giraldi has come on the show year after year. He always reviews the terrorism report, and he's come on, former CIA guy. He comes on year after year saying, well, see, you know, when the government's actually being honest, never mind all their, you know, pep talk nonsense on TV, when they're actually being honest and writing up a report, they admit there's only a couple of thousand real dangerous terrorists in the world. And in fact, you know, as we can all see, all our military force applied against them simply makes matters worse everywhere we go. So the deal is ramp down all the occupations, ramp down all the wars, ramp down all the support for all of the dictators and the revolutionaries around the Middle East. And support for these guys will dry up. And then you use cops for the last few who are the incorrigible ones. And then you prosecute them in New York or Virginia. And then you're done, and then it's all good. Instead, what we've done... Oh, but now, so this report is coming out, and I haven't read the whole thing. I did scan through it. I haven't read the whole thing. I doubt that they take responsibility for the American Empire anywhere in the report. We are talking about a State Department report. But I think that this is right. That we have a real problem now. The Western world, the Middle East too, now has a real problem with Al-Qaeda-ish terrorism. And you know what, man? Again, with the whole here we are in the future looking back, I've been telling you for 10 years. Creating a whole new generation of terrorists. All the polls, remember after the Iraq war, all the polls were, does the Iraq invasion make you feel safer? That was the actual poll question. Do you feel safer? And I would always cover those stories, and I would say, you are not safer. Your feelings are stupid. You have just put yourself in much greater danger by doing what you've done. And I've been right this whole time, and now look at us. Look at what's happened here. They spread jihad all over the place. George Bush accidentally did the best thing for bin Laden-style terrorism that anybody had ever done, ever, by overthrowing Saddam Hussein and turning the Anbar and other northern and Sunni-dominated provinces into lawless, basically terror training camps. And then Obama's doubled down and made it all worse, especially with his invasions, really with his entire policy, pro and con Al-Qaeda, right? He fights Al-Qaeda in Afghanistan, Pakistan. Well, they don't really exist there. Yemen, Somalia. They don't really exist in Somalia either. In Yemen, I guess you can call those guys Al-Qaeda guys. Anyway, he fights jihadists there. But then he fights for them in Libya and Syria. And so I don't know. In the grand scheme of things, let's pretend it's 100 years from now. Looking back, which was more consequential for the future of bin Ladenite movements in the world? Was it the invasion of Iraq, or was it really Obama's doubling down by invading Libya and Syria as well and turning them into failed states full of warring jihadist suicide bomber lunatics? This is going to be a real problem. And you know what? The next time these guys come to America and have a plan for a mass-scale attack, you're going to find later that the FBI was too busy entrapping some idiot to be paying attention to what's really going on in the world and who might really be coming their way. You know, I had the clip. I don't think I have it handy. Do I have it? I may have. No, I don't think I set this one up, did I? I have the clip somewhere of the FBI agent being asked, what's the difference between Hezbollah and Al-Qaeda? No, I don't have it queued up for you here on the list, unfortunately. What's the difference between Hezbollah and Al-Qaeda? And the FBI head of counterterrorism said, Remember that? I think it was the same reporter asked Sylvester Reyes, who's the fixing to be, I guess, at that time after Harmon lost the spot, he became the chair of the House Intelligence Committee, and he was asked the same question, and he didn't know anything about it either. And in fact, I can't remember if it was Sylvester Reyes, the head of the House Intelligence Committee, or whether it was, what's his name, the head of the FBI's counterterrorism division, who was asked the follow-up, well, where does Hezbollah live? Can you tell me where is Hezbollah? And they didn't even know the answer to that. Let me see if I can find this, man, because that would be so fun if I could find... Oh, come on. I get nothing for FBI? You know what? It goes by their names. I didn't put FBI in the name of the clips, unfortunately. It's the names of the agents, and I don't remember the names of the agents, so I can't play the clip. Ah, well. Hell. But anyway, this is a real problem. There are now thousands and thousands of these bin Ladenite types around the Middle East, and, you know, they don't really have... at this point, much need to attack the United States. America's already doing exactly what they're supposed to do in chasing the red cape off the cliff. If I can screw up a couple of mixed metaphors there. Broken the bank and worked out exactly what bin Laden wanted. In fact, that's an Anand Gopal story. Anand Gopal found the letter. Should ask him about this next time we talk again, how he got this. But I think he got this from the Taliban. He had a letter from Osama bin Laden to Mullah Omar saying, man, you know what? Their response was worse than I thought it was going to be, and I'm sorry. But just wait 10 years, and you'll see that I'm right, that everything is going to go exactly like I predicted. The Americans are going to drive themselves to bankruptcy. We'll survive and prevail in the end. Our side will, and they'll lose, and blah, blah, blah. Just like it's played out. I'm a reverse 9/11 truther. I think that Bush and Cheney worked for bin Laden instead of the other way around, like all the other truthers think. Since they did, they were the puppets on his strings much more than the other way around. It sure looks like when you look at the results. Anyway, oh, and I wanted to mention Nigeria too, because you're always going to have these right-wing backwoods kooks like Boko Haram around the world as the future rolls forward, but it's American foreign policy that has led them to try to identify with broader global jihadist movements and has probably served to strengthen them and has certainly served to give the Americans excuses to intervene in Nigeria as much as they want into the future now, too. Phone records, financial and location data, Prism, Tempora, X-Keyscore, Boundless Informant. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for offnow.org. Now, here's the deal. Due to the Snowden revelations, we have a great opportunity for a short period of time to get some real rollback of the national surveillance state. Now, they're already trying to tire us by introducing fake reforms in the Congress. And the courts, they betrayed their sworn oaths to the Constitution and Bill of Rights again and again, and can in no way be trusted to stop the abuses for us. We've got to do it ourselves. How? We nullify it at the state level. It's still not easy, but the OffNow project of the 10th Amendment Center has gotten off to a great start. I mean it. There's real reason to be optimistic here. They've gotten their model legislation introduced all over the place, in state after state. I've lost count, more than a dozen. You're always wondering, yeah, but what can we do? Here's something. Something important. Something that can work if we do the work. Get started cutting off the NSA support in your state. Go to offnow.org. All right, so I found those clips. They're real short. Let's see. I don't remember exactly what they are. It was right around the same time that Sylvester Reyes was put on the spot, too. The head of the House Intelligence Committee. Hey, do you know anything about what you're doing? Huh? Me? Well, I hadn't, like, read any books about it or nothing. Okay, good. That's going to prove to be a problem later on, I think. All right. So, hey, listen, I forgot to give out the number. I'm not used to having to try to remember to give out the number. But I like doing calls, and if you guys want to do calls, that's good. 512-271-4836. 512-271-4836. If you want to talk about Iraq, Syria, Ukraine, whatever. Lots to talk about. Gareth Porter coming up about the chemical weapons attack to follow up from yesterday there. Oh, and you know what? Damn it. I didn't get to ask Anand Gopal about this great article, The Ghost Polls of Afghanistan, about these recent elections. Anyway, power. So how is that supposed to hold for the long term when it's all obviously the whole time a distortion? You know, it's like when they did regime change in Japan from the militarists to the parliamentarian types. They already had parliamentarian types that the militarists had seized power from. So they were able to sort of devolve back to the old system a bit. You know? There ain't much of that going on here. The Afghan War, co-authored with a guy named Michael Shank from the Friends Committee. What? The Quaker, peaceniks, pacifists. Co-authored this piece here with Daniel Davis, an active duty lieutenant colonel in the U.S. Army, about America's role in provoking the problems in Ukraine. And in the pages of U.S. News and World Report, which is the conservative one. All right. And then now, more Ukraine. Kerry claims secret proof of Russian involvement, tape conversations, he says. Well, if that's true, why didn't he post it on YouTube? That's what the Russians did. And this is also apparently at the Trilateral Commission meeting that Josh Rogan got the audio. And this could be true. I mean, hell, I don't know. It would make perfect sense. Continental ballistic missiles are made in eastern Ukraine. Maybe that's what Foreign Affairs editor Gideon Rose meant when he called Ukraine Robin to Russia's Batman. You could see why they do not plan. You could see why they took Crimea back, and you could see why they do not plan on letting the East go. You know, if you care to pay attention, unlike the people in charge of the policy. Anyway, instead of the stupid Benghazi thing, he's the guy who plagiarized from other people's reporting all over the place. I don't know how they got away with this, but there's a very interesting piece at VanityFair.com, Snowden Speaks, a Vanity Fair special report, and it's just the story of Ed Snowden, and I think it's good, although they should have given credit to the, I don't know, 10 or 15 or 20 other reporters who they ripped off in writing this thing, but that's at VanityFair.com. Okay, be right back with Gareth in a sec. Oh, John Kerry's Mideast peace talks have gone nowhere. Hey, I'll Scott Horton here for the Council for the National Interest. A council for... So we welcome the great Gareth Porter back to the show. Welcome back to the show, Gareth.
Thanks very much. Glad
very
to be
happy
back
to have
again,
you here.
Scott.
That's your heroic theme music there.
It does sound like some sort of Superman film. I don't know.
It's Spaceballs.
It's what?
Spaceballs.
I don't know that. Okay,
I can't see a thing in this helmet. No? Anyway. All right, so listen... you wrote this thing for the Truth Out there, truthout.org, as you sometimes do. This one is called New Data Not, and so that scotched the whole damn thing. They didn't get to have their war, and then all we found out since then basically seems to be reason to doubt the casus belli that they were attempting to invoke back then. So very important, very instructive. And this is also part two then of this interview, because we talked about kind of the overall gist of it, as well as the first couple of reasons why now looking back, you find it so unlikely that the official story was correct. And so I think...
He was skeptical about some of the evidence suggesting, particularly on the side of the question of the symptoms that were being exhibited in videos and also eventually in the UN report. And so he has started out as a sort of an independent voice, skeptical voice, but has now aligned himself with the Elliot Higgins view that this must have been a government operation, widely used, I'm sorry to say, as a sort of benchmark, despite the fact that it's really quite irrelevant to the reality of the specifics of this attack. So I'm just pointing to the fact that there has been this back and forth between people on that side versus some of the people on the blog who attacked Huta, including this fellow Charles Wood, who is a Perth, Australia-based forensic expert, and they've been carrying out a very strong response, have waged a strong response to some of the arguments that have been made, and in my view have actually produced more convincing evidence in that exchange, and that's so it's quite interesting that you've got a discourse that is really the U.S. government has been not involved in at all, and has been carried out by these experts on the two contracts. And that is supposed to be one of the, well, it is in fact the primary symptom. It's the first symptom that you would find within 3 minutes of serious exposure to sarin. You would have that as a symptom. And yet, only a small minority, as I recall, around 15, 16, 17% of the total of the 36 people showed any sign of meiosis. There's something wrong with that, and what that means, and Cazetta is the one who first commented.
Whatever you need, they've got it. Just click the Amazon logo on the right side of the page at scotthorton.org, or go to scotthorton.org/Amazon. All right, you guys, welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, Scott Horton Show. As always, I'm talking with the great Gareth Porter from Interpress Service, ipsnews.net, truthout.org, and amazon.com. Actually, make that scotthorton.org/Amazon, where you can find Gareth's great new book. It's so important. I really mean it, man. That's the reason I always talk to him, is because he's the best. And now here he is, the best in book form, Manufactured Crisis, debunking every lie about the Iran nuclear program and the supposed threat it poses to Israel and the United States of America and world order, anything else. The idea that it exists at all. He absolutely destroys it. You can hear my 10-part interview series with him on Manufactured Crisis at scotthorton.org/stress. Got them all there for you. And /interviews, of course. But we got them all combined even into one giant file now. And people can come to reasonable terms. Man, it's about damn time. It's overdue, and it's important. And the book is Manufactured Crisis. Okay, whew, thank you. Now, again, the new article here at Truthout is: new data raised further doubt on official view of the August 21st gas attack in Syria. And so now I'm trying to figure out exactly how this argument goes, Gareth, but it's something to the effect of, at first, well, these rockets traveled 9 kilometers. Of course, the rebels don't have anything
on the tail fins of rockets. So the idea that they were not interested in or capable of manufacturing facsimiles of these rockets and adapting them to chemical warfare would simply be unrealistic. It's very clear that they have all the capability that they need in order to make those rockets and to adapt them.
All right, well, so now what about the supposed exact nature of the replication here, though, all the way down to...
In fact, yeah. I mean, the same argument was being made. You're absolutely right. The same argument was being made by people in the U.S. military and the Bush administration that, those EFPs could not have been made by Iraqis. They must have been. They're too well made to be, anything but an Iranian
made. But copper, Gareth, yeah. Copper.
Yeah, right, of course.
what could an Arab possibly do with copper? It just doesn't make sense. They have to be Iranian.
But as we now know, I mean, the U.S. military had to walk that argument back because there were explicit finds that were reported in the news media of workshops that were producing precisely those sorts of EFPs. I mean, you know, were there slight differences? Perhaps so, but they were functioning exactly in the same way, is the point.
You know, I don't know the footnote anymore, but Phil Giraldi, and we talked about this at such length back in 07 and 08 and all that during that propaganda that were discussed, not just people in
alternative
media. There are so many ways in which that whole story could be completely distorted or simply totally false.
Let me ask you this here real quick. I'm sorry, we're so short on time, Gareth.
Yeah.
But what about what Hearst says about porting down laboratory in the UK debunked that it was the same recipe at all? Did you agree with that in your research?
Well,
do you know about that?
You
can find certainly all the IPS stuff. All of the IPS stuff is at antiwar.com as well. original.antiwar.com/porter if you want to find it there. Probably a lot of the truth out and maybe some other miscellaneous stuff in there too. Anyway, and the book is Manufactured Crisis. Okay, thanks y'all for listening. See ya.